Hello, my friends. Welcome to the Hello Tomorrow podcast, where we make sense of what's next in about 20 minutes every week. I'm your host, Josh Allen Dykstra. As always, I'm going to do my best to cut through the noise and expose the systems that are secretly shaping our future. Our goal? Leave here with more clarity and a little bit of optimistic rebellion. Last week, I shared an episode about income and how AI, if it works the way tech bros say it will, and we get to AGI and our machines can do most everything we can do, if that happens, AI will end up functionally destroying our current economic loop. I called this episode, "Who Buys Your Stuff, Robots?" And, well, caught a bit of fire on YouTube. I posted it last Tuesday. I went to bed that night with 91 YouTube subscribers. I remember because I thought, I wonder when I'll get to 100. And I woke up to 50 more subscribers and 1,000 views on the video. And it turned out it was just getting started. As of now, last week's episode has 24,000 views, 800 comments, 1,600 likes. I am blown away. I am so delighted this is resonating. I'm really brand new to this video medium. I've been sharing written content online forever, like since 2005. But video, this is different, isn't it? It's really fun to be able to connect with you all this way. So I'm really just sharing this to say thank you. I hope a lot of you who found my work last week are back again today. And thank you to everybody on YouTube who left really thoughtful questions, encouragements, kind words, recommendations for other books and authors and thinkers who've written on this topic. I'm doing my best to read and respond to what you're sharing. You are making this conversation better. I am so glad you are here. I'm glad you're all here. Okay, I know last week I also promised you something that blew my mind a little bit. So let's get into it. Today, I'm going to take you on a bit of a thrill ride that concerns one of the least thrilling, sexy things that I can think of, debt. I know that might sound completely ridiculous, but I did not anticipate the mind-bending adventure this topic would take me on, and I want to take you on that journey now. All right, here's what happened. Last time, we talked about the loop that holds up the world, and I showed you a diagram, a simple loop, right? Labor, which leads to wages, which gives you income, which allows you to buy stuff, which is consumption, which makes revenue for another company and back to their labor, and it loops around. When I made this diagram, I used the word income for simplicity. Right before I posted the last episode, I realized income isn't exactly what I meant. Income is everything you bring in. What I really mean to be right there is what's left over after you've paid your bills, because that's what we ought to be using to buy things, right? What do we call that? I thought for a moment, realized I didn't know the answer to this question. I was a bit blindsided, both by the not knowing and by the realization that I'd never thought about this before. So basically the question is, what do we call profit for individuals or families? You know what I mean? Like, profit is what's left over after you've paid your expenses in a company. We all get that. But what do you call that same money when you've paid all your expenses at home? Savings? Kind of implies that it's sitting in a bank. Disposable income? That's actually a specific term used for what's left after taxes, not expenses. Margin, feels even more businessy than profit. Emergency fund, feels like money for savings, not for spendings. Right? Discretionary income, better, I think, but kind of has a connotation of frivolity to it. Surplus, this might be the most accurate word, but when's the last time you heard someone say, "Yep, we got household surplus this month"? Yeah, me neither. As I went through this list, something clicked for me. Isn't it strange that we all understand exactly what profit is, but we don't even have a word for its equivalent in our personal lives? I've always been kind of obsessed with language. I love great lyrics. I love clever wordplay. I've enjoyed reading and writing ever since I could do either of those things. But if memory serves, what really unleashed a new depth on the topic of language for me was a book I read in college called Metaphors We Live By. I'd never considered how metaphors shape our thinking. Since then, I've come to believe a few truths about language. Number one, language is formative. We think in language. So this means if we change the words we use, we can actually change the way we think. Number two, Language indicates our worldview. The words we use always give away our capacity for the world we're presently able to see. Number three, language always has a framing power. The words you choose to use, to a large degree, dictate what other people will be looking at when they hear your language. Last week, I added another insight to my list. Language indicates what matters. We give words to things we care about. Businesses have profit. Investors have returns. Families have nothing? It feels about right, but honestly, that leftover money, the surplus, is actually what fuels the consumption part of the loop. Without it, the loop fails. It's profit, but for individuals and families, and we don't have a word for it. How is it possible that we don't have a word for such an important part of the loop that holds up the world? This blows my mind. Now, the answer reveals the most important dividing line in capitalism, one we're taught not to see. Inside capitalism, there are two basic roles, labor and capital. If you are labor, you sell your time and energy via work. You get paid after your work is done. If you are capital, you own assets, and your assets make you more money. And here's the quiet rule built into the system that we don't talk about. If you are labor, surplus is a problem. Surplus gives you breathing room. Breathing room gives you choice. Choice gives you leverage. So, well, the system doesn't really want you to have those things. Why? As always, because it doesn't make more capital. So personal surplus is squeezed down as close to nothing as possible. But if you're capital, surplus is the point. It actually has a lot of language over there. Profit, returns, yield, appreciation. Same economy, two completely different relationships to surplus. Okay. I know I promised you some sultry pillow talk about debt, and we're ready to go there now. Okay, because the real baller capitalist move isn't just reducing personal surplus. It's eliminating surplus entirely, so completely that you need something else to cover your basic needs. What is that thing? You guessed it, debt. I'm not talking about buying luxuries, my friends. I'm just talking about life, housing, healthcare, education, transportation, emergencies. Can you pay for any of these without debt? Did you buy your house without debt? If something unexpected happens, can you cover the medical bills? Could you pay for college in cash? How about your car? Do you pay for that outright? And you got a stash of gold for your emergency fund, right? Do you see it? When surplus disappears, debt stops being optional and starts being necessary. And that's the point. It's not a conspiracy. It's just good capitalism. Because if you rely on debt to live, you are permanently tied to future work. You can't pause. You can't refuse. You can't walk away. Debt replaces surplus as the buffer. Credit replaces savings as the safety net. And the system no longer needs to pay you enough to live. It just needs to make sure you can borrow the difference. That's not a wage failure. That's a design failure. This is what we're told to be grateful for. Now, there's actually one more layer of mind bending here. You ready? What is debt? Ask me this question 2 weeks ago, and I would have said, I understand debt pretty darn well. I got student loans. I've bought and sold houses. I've built companies with lines of credit, raised money, filed a bankruptcy. I got a pretty solid understanding of what debt is. Thank you very much. But I didn't really get it. I mentioned this briefly in last week's episode when we talked about capitalism not being a growth system, but a system that feeds on growth, right? Capitalism requires continuous growth because it borrows from the future to function in the present. And the future has to keep getting bigger to cover the tab. Right? Continual growth can only happen when there's something continual to extract. Right? The five most common things being labor, energy, land, attention, and debt. I think it's relatively straightforward to see how capitalism extracts from the first four. Let's go through them. Labor. Yeah, I think you get this one pretty intimately. Almost all of us feel this every day because we are the labor being extracted from. Okay, energy. Well, we literally extract resources out of the earth and burn them to power all our stuff. Okay, how about land? Well, when we want a piece of land, we just displace any other species on it, right? You've seen humans do this, right? Yeah. But attention, we will endless scroll, doom scroll, micro dopamine hit ourselves to death. But what about debt? What does extraction have to do with debt? Well, this is where we all become futurists. Debt, my friends, is an extraction of your future labor. Debt is simply a claim on labor that you will labor in the future. When you take on debt, you're not spending what you have, you're committing time you haven't lived yet. Future hours, future energy, future attention. Oh, and with interest. Whew, credit cards aren't just convenience. Mortgages aren't just about the American dream. These things are the way good capitalism keeps consumption going even when the surplus is long gone. And this isn't new. For most of human history, though, debt was local and relational. Neighbors owed neighbors. Merchants extended trust. Debt was visible and human scale, bounded by relationship. Now, when credit works like that, there's natural limits. People don't extract endlessly from people they have to see every day. Reputation matters, community matters, but that kind of system doesn't scale. So, for most of human history, debt was temporary. You borrowed for a season, for a bad harvest, for a specific need. And then, this is critical, the debt ended. Debt had a beginning and an end, and most people expected to live large parts of their lives not owing anyone anything. But by the early 1900s, mortgages started lengthening. By the 1930s, 30-year mortgages became the new normal. Not short loans, not emergency credit, decades-long commitments. For the first time at scale, people weren't just borrowing to get through a rough patch. They were borrowing in a way that shaped their entire adult life. Homes weren't being bought with money people had saved. They were being bought with 30 years of promised work. And from that moment on, the economy wasn't just built on what existed today. It was built on the assumption that people would keep showing up to work without interruption for decades. Now this is where George Bailey comes in. Have you seen this movie, It's a Wonderful Life? If you have, you probably remember the bank run scene with George pleading to everyone to understand something vitally important about their money. Here, you gotta listen to Jimmy Stewart do it, of course.
Well, no, Charlie, I didn't even ask him. We don't need Potter over here.
And I'll take mine now.
No, but you're thinking of this place all wrong, as if I had the money back in a safe. The money's not here. Well, your money's in Joe's house. That's right next to yours. And in the Kennedy house, and Mrs. Maitland's house, and 100 others. You're lending them the money to build, and then they're going to pay it back to you as best they can. Now, what are you going to do, foreclose on them?
And he goes on, convinces the town to band together, and uses the money he was going to spend on his honeymoon to float everybody in the near term. That scene is showing us what the world used to be and could become again. George is trying to hold on to a form of credit that was already disappearing. He's trying to keep debt human in a world that's learned how to make it abstract. That's why this scene feels so emotional. We're not watching a normal banker. We're watching a man fighting the tide of capital. To us today, George Bailey represents the road not taken, a system where credit stayed relational and limited and accountable to its community. Now, the villain of that movie, of course, is Mr. Potter, who represents a financial system where debt is detached from people, scaled up, optimized for extraction. That's why this movie lands 80 years later. Yes, seriously, it came out in 1946. We recognize today, instantly, that once debt is no longer personal, it becomes something else, something extractive and dark. Once debt stretches across decades, it stops being a tool you use occasionally and starts becoming the condition you live inside. When debt becomes that kind of monster, the question changes from, can I pay this back, to, can I keep working long enough to survive this? That is a completely different relationship to debt, and it changes our behavior. We can't walk away. We can't pause. We can't stop running because our future income is already spoken for. This is why we so badly need a new organizing story. It still could be a wonderful life, but we're going to need new beliefs and new structures to make this possible. If all this is starting to feel familiar, that's not an accident. Once you see how debt really works, how it pulls value from the future to keep the present moving, you start seeing the same pattern in other places too. For example, we see it in technology right now with a possible AI investment bubble. Entire companies, industries are being valued not on what exists today, but on what the future is expected to deliver. Productivity gains that haven't materialized yet, profits that don't exist yet either. It's the same move. When growth runs out of real things to extract in the present, it turns to the future. In finance, we call it debt. In tech, we call it investment. In real estate, we call it a mortgage. In everyday life, we call it credit cards. Different arenas, same logic. It's all about pulling from tomorrow to keep today going. And once we recognize that pattern, it becomes hard to unsee because it's not an exception. It's how the system keeps functioning. If this feels heavy or familiar, I think it's because you already felt it in your body. Like me before, maybe. You just didn't have the language to express it. You know, and I know, we can't quit. We can't pause. We can't miss a paycheck. We can't risk that instability. The constant background noise, that continual underlying stress, that sense that one wrong move could unravel everything, that's not personal failure. It's what it feels like to live in a system where surplus has been systematically removed from your field of possibilities and debt has taken its place. Of course, life feels heavy. The Optimistic Rebellion this week, it's important. It's not fixing you. It's not quite yet, taking on the system. We'll get there. But today, the rebellion is giving yourself grace. You are not doing this wrong. You didn't choose this pressure. You didn't design this system. The system chose these conditions for you. So this week, your assignment as a rebel is to take an extra breath. And when the stress shows up, remind yourself, this kind of pressure was never meant to be carried alone. Reach out to someone. Share this episode as a conversation starter. Get coffee with a friend. Share the weight. Help each other. Clarity is the first form of freedom. And once we see the system clearly, we can't unsee it. So take a breath. Give yourself grace. And then, when you're ready, start asking out loud, why do I have to borrow against my future just to live in the present? When enough of us start asking that question, we'll be able to change the system. If I can help your leaders or your organization make sense of what's next, come find me at joshallan.com, joshallan.com. Thank you for listening. See you next week.